Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm him. It should be a good one for you today. I got Dar Jamail. He's done a hell of a lot of quite heroic journalism out of Iraq over the past decade. And he'll be on to talk about what's going on there. It's a lot, and it's important. I'm going to get an Iraq update from him. And then Daniel McAdams is going to be here from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. I think that's what, ronpaulinstitute.org? Let me get that right for you. ronpaulinstitute.org. I did get it right. And Dan is going to be on to talk about Eastern Europe and the new Cold War. I'd like to say it's unbelievable, but nah, not really. I guess in some senses of that term. All right, so the good news is that Walter Jones won his primary, anti-war Republican out of North Carolina. I thought that was good. Walter Jones, he's not exactly Ron Paul, but he likes Ron Paul. And he's the guy, you know, he's the guy who proposed that the Capitol building cafeteria change French fries to freedom fries when the French wouldn't get on board for the aggressive war against Iraq. But the truth is, he's a faithful believer, I think a Catholic, and he decided that his soul was in real jeopardy for supporting that war. And what really did it was he's from a military district, and so he had to write a lot of letters home to parents of deceased kids, and he could no longer believe the lie he was telling them, that it was for a good enough reason. Thanks for your sacrifice, because, hey, it was worth it, and he decided it wasn't worth it. And they've been trying to get rid of him ever since, and they put a Bush staffer up against him or something. I don't know a lot about it. I think Danny McAdams will be able to tell us a little bit more about it, maybe. But and they spent a lot of money, including William Kristol's group, the Foreign Policy Initiative, ran ads against Walter Jones and attacked him all about foreign policy. He's not tough enough on foreign policy. This Republican, anti-war Republican from a military district, and, well, he won that primary. So, as Trita Parsi put it today, not only do the Republican leadership, not only do they not understand the American people, but they don't understand Republican primary voters. Yeah, yeah, people like strutting around like a tough guy, but they also like to see their sons grow up all the way and not die in their 20s. So, anyway, it's kind of a big deal to people, you know? So, I'm happy to see that. Now, Walter Jones, he's far from perfect. I mean, I don't ever, at least he doesn't fake it. But I don't see him, sticking up for dead civilians in any of these wars. Not really, just dead American soldiers in them. And so, you know, he's still pretty conservative and nationalist and not libertarian on the issue, but he's pretty damn good for a Republican. And I think, you know, what's most important is what it shows about the voting public out there, that they made sure he won. And he did. So, that's good. All right. And now, I guess to talk about the Rand Paul thing. So, Rand Paul, when he does things, sometimes they're good. This one is he's putting a hold on a nominee for a federal judge, a guy named David Barron, who, when working for the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel, wrote one of these memos, supposedly legalizing or instructing the president that it's legal for him to assassinate Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born American citizen that Obama murdered with a drone in Yemen, killing another American citizen, Samir Khan, who was with him, and then 2 weeks later, his son, his 16-year-old son. And Paul's saying, release the memo, the whole thing, the real thing, not the little white paper. Release the whole thing. And a judge recently ordered this to happen. I guess they're resisting. And then he's going to release the hold on the judge, which, geez, I don't know, man. Doesn't it kind of depend what the memo says? Whether this guy gets to become a federal judge or not? But anyway, still, I don't see any other senator doing this. And we're talking about the claimed power of an American president to murder an American citizen. And you go through their white paper, it's a joke. After the U.S. has determined that, one, an individual poses an imminent threat. But we already know that imminent doesn't mean imminent. Imminent means they think that maybe someday somebody might do something. Not what imminent means to you or me. Their own new definition of the term imminent. Capture is not feasible. Well, people get arrested in Yemen all the time. They make it sound like it's a battlefield when it's really not. And now in some cases, it might be difficult to arrest somebody, but that doesn't mean that it is not feasible to find al-Awlaki and arrest him or have him arrested, negotiate his surrender perhaps through his family, anything like that. They didn't try any of that. They didn't want to try any of that. They wanted to kill him. It's not like they have a chain of events where they can say, see all the times we tried to figure out a peaceful resolution of this? No. They just hunted him until they found him, and then they killed him. And then it says, and three, it must be conducted in a manner consistent with applicable law of war principles. Well, Yemen's not a battlefield. So, there's that. And this guy was a propagandist. And they've never proven that he had anything to do with the planning of the cartridge bomb attack or with the underpants attack or with any other thing out of Yemen. Is there any other thing they accused him of? They've never proven it. They never showed it. They've asserted a couple of times that he was some operational commander, but really what he was an interviewee in their magazine. And a propagandist on YouTube. And certainly in spirit was a traitor to this society, not just to this government, this country, but he had outright sided with the butchers of 9/11. And was a horrible, terrible person. But I don't even think they had a treason case on him. They didn't even have a criminal case on him. So they just murdered him. But anyway, so it's good to see Rand Paul doing the right thing here. I like to encourage him to do the right thing. And I think, you know, his people ought to take note that it's when he does the right thing that people like him. When he does the wrong thing, Jennifer Rubin says, well, kind of, but eh. But when he does the right thing, complete strangers go, who's this guy again? Well, that's a pretty good deal. He's going to block the judge until they come clean with the kill Americans with drones memo, huh? That sounds all right. Don't drone me, bro, and all that. People are waiting for even minor heroics. We'll take them, you know? And in this era, just doing the decent thing at all is basically heroic for people in power. So, yeah, on a comparative basis, you know. Anyway. And then also on the subject of Rand Paul, let me say real quick, on antiwar.com today, you can find two different articles. Rand Paul represents the foreign policy mainstream by Jack Hunter, and Rand Paul plays the Israel card by Phil Giraldi. And they're both right. And Jack, he doesn't talk about Israel in there at all, really, I don't think. I don't think the word even comes up. But he says, look, Rand Paul was against Libya and against Syria, and I forget what all, you know, he takes all of the places where Rand actually has taken a dovish position, which is not all things. And he says, and the American people agree with him. So why do the Republicans keep pretending like he's a kook when his views line up with the views of the American people on foreign intervention? And their views are the ones that are far discredited and outside the mainstream. And he's right about that. If he's wrong about anything in there, really, it's that Rand is as good as he sort of just characterizes him as. When in fact, the American people might be better on a lot of these things than even Rand is. Son of Ron. And that ought to be a real lesson to him, that you can go ahead and be at least as dovish as the American people. You might even lead them to an even more peaceful position. Might consider trying, but you can be at least as good as Americans on this stuff. But that's where Giraldi's piece comes in. Rand Paul plays the Israel card. The disgusting pandering by Rand Paul to the Israel lobby. And, you know, Justin Raimondo has a thing saying, oh, he's too clever by half because now Israel just have to pay the aid to the PLO that America doesn't have to pay or whatever. That's not what it's about. What it's about is all his demands on the Palestinian Authority of what they have to do. And, of course, the fact that he's, you know, trying to mimic his father's position against foreign aid, but only on regarding countries that are Israel's enemies is a bit transparent.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Oh, yeah, I forgot to sign up the chat room today, man. If you guys want to join up the chat room, it's at scotthorton.org/chat. I like it when the CAPTCHA is a number. Because, man, a lot of times the letters are so damn twisted I can't tell what they say. This is going to work first try, though. Here, let me in. Let me in, I say. Oh, man, they didn't like my CAPTCHA. All right, well, hell. I'm trying to join up the chat room, everybody. You can, too, at scotthorton.org. It's an IRC-free node chat. You can get to it in just a plain old browser window. You don't need any kind of external chat device type thing, you know, like Chatzilla or XChat or Pigeon or any of that. You can just go to scotthorton.org/chat and log right in. After a couple of tries at the CAPTCHA anyway, you ought to be able to get in there. Hey, everybody. All right. scotthorton.org/chat for that. And, yeah, I guess I should tell you I'm at APSRadioNews.com. I'm also at DailyPaulRadio.com, at ScottHorton.org. Oh, AnomalyRadio.com. I should have said that. And then ScottHorton.org. And then who knows where else. I don't know. What was on this thing called Liberty Movement Radio? I don't think I'm still on there anymore.
I don't know. Maybe I am. That'd be cool. Anyway. All right. Hey, guys. So, this is my show. And, yeah. So. Yeah, read Phil. Go to antiwar.com today. Take a look at all those Rand Paul articles if you want. There's one at Reason about his hold on the drone strike thing. That's so important. You know what? As long as we're talking about the power of the president to... not that there's a law that says this anywhere. It's just their claimed interpretation of the authorization to use military force and whatever other executive powers and whatever. It's secret. We don't know exactly what their reasoning is, but their claimed authority, the president's claimed authority to murder American citizens. At the same time, and this almost sounds like a bunch of crap. It sounds like something that's not true, but no, it's true. And that is that not only has the Congress passed a law and the president signed a law, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, passed at the end of 2011, signed by the president on New Year's Eve, when no one was paying attention. And every version of the National Defense Authorization Act, that's their annual appropriations bill, full of all kinds of evil. This is just one small section of it. Each version of it since then has included this as well. And it is the power of the president to have American citizens arrested on American soil, turned over to the military, to be held indefinitely without charges, to basically be given the Guantanamo treatment or the Jose Padilla treatment. Now, when George W. Bush did this to Jose Padilla, the Supreme Court at first ducked it on standing, and then on the second time around, Bush ducked it by, he denied the plaintiff's standing good and well by removing Jose Padilla from military custody, from CIA torture, and turning him over to the Justice Department, who went ahead and indicted him and prosecuted him in federal court and convicted him not of a dirty bomb plot or an apartment building high-rise plot. Those were lies tortured with Binyam Mohammed, tortured out of Binyam Mohammed with razor blades by the CIA in a dungeon in Morocco. But they charged him with knowing a guy who knew a guy who helped the jihad in Chechnya or something like that, some garbage. But anyway, because Bush knew that the Supreme Court wasn't going to let him get away with that, right? Or at least he was afraid they wouldn't. So he went ahead and... And the same case for Al-Mari, even though he was not an American citizen, he was a U.S. person arrested in Peoria, which is the joke, right? The cliche for every town USA. He was arrested at the community college there in Peoria, Illinois, and held... You know, how's it play in Peoria, right? Is that a Richard Nixon thing? Middle America defined kind of place, right? Anyway. Same difference, and they ended up letting him go as well. But now this is the... Now Congress, this isn't just executive claims of power by the likes of George Bush. This is now Congress has passed this law, and the president has signed it. And the fact that he added a signing statement to it saying, oh, but I don't mean that I'll ever actually do this to an American, is just proof of how dangerous it is that we would rely on a president's promised policy in the signing statement that has no force of law whatsoever. Which I don't know why they bother even passing laws anymore at this point anyway. Let's let the dictator do what he wants and then everybody three cheers and then on to the next one, right? What's the problem? Why would they even bother? But now the Supreme Court has ducked the case. And on the same grounds that they ducked the Padilla case. You don't have standing to sue. Well, the lawsuit is by someone, and a lower court held that they did have standing. The lawsuit is by the likes of Daniel Ellsberg and Chris Hedges and others. And Chris Hedges, before he was a communist whiner, was a writer for the New York Times. I wonder if he whined all the time while he worked there, reporting fake Al-Qaeda Iraq connections and so forth. But anyway, so... He at some point talked to at least purported Al-Qaeda guys. I don't know if Chalabi had just hooked him up with some fakes or what. But anyway, he was saying to the judge, hey, man, so I have had association with Al-Qaeda. I have put their quotes in the paper. So does that amount to material support? I don't know, because you define it very broadly. And what's an associated force? What if I interviewed somebody from Al-Shabaab and somebody else from Al-Shabaab has been accused of crossing the sea and going to Yemen and training on the jungle gym over there before coming back, you know, doing the monkey bars and the jumping jacks and the spin kicks and all, and then coming back and being an Al-Qaeda warrior? Does that mean that a former New York Times reporter can be held indefinitely without charges for the rest of his life? And if he doesn't have standing, then who does? Somebody who's already been secretly abducted and kidnapped and is being held by the military somewhere? And I don't know all the reasons for their suspicions on this, but Chris Hedges wrote in his article that the lawyers are quite suspicious that the reason they were so intent on getting this law passed is because they're already using it, and that there are already Americans, probably Somali Americans, for example, or others who have left America to go fight on the other side in the war, or somewhere or another, wherever somewhere America's at war, and that they've already been abducted and they're already being held without charges. And that the NSA, the NDAA, is just CYA. And that very well could be. But the fact that the Supreme Court has ducked the NDAA case, I mean, you talk about a fire bell in the night and all of that kind of thing. This is the unraveling of the very definition of what makes our society, supposedly. We don't have soldiers on our streets. Go to Mexico, even to a tourist trap, and there's soldiers with machine guns, real-ass machine guns, standing around everywhere. You know, like our cops wannabe. But they're actually just soldiers. And we don't have that here because, hey, this is the USA, and this and that, and the other thing. Only that's the way it's going now. We've got a president who claims the authority to murder American citizens. Got a court that refuses to do a thing about that. We've got a Congress and a president who think that they conspire to tap everybody's phone in direct violation of the Bill of Rights. We got a Supreme Court who won't do a thing about that. Again, they duck it based on standing. If you can't prove that they're illegally spying on you, then we don't have to hear your case. And now the same thing, too, with this conspiracy, this plot by the Congress in the form of them passing a bill directly against the language of the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and for that matter, Article 1, Section 9, claiming the authority to have the military abduct American citizens and hold them without charges. And the court won't do a thing about that. And so, you know, I don't know if you're waiting until they're rounding up people in your neighborhood. Maybe you should wait until then. I sort of get the idea that, hey, you know, their experiments on our liberty at this point are getting a little bit out of control, guys. I guess we could test them and see just how far they're willing to go before we hightail it out of here. Where? To Mexico? I know the news is on. Sorry, here's your Fox News. More expert complaining about the end of America right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for OffNow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, it's libertarian foreign policy mostly. Not entirely. Hey, if you want to talk on the show, go ahead and call in. You can talk about whatever. I didn't come up with a question of the day or anything. You can talk about Rand Paul if you want. You can talk about Central Texas woman, 93, shot dead by police in Bryan, Texas. In Hearne. The hell is Hearne? That's how big Texas is. You can be from Central Texas and not know where other towns in Central Texas are. Maybe or maybe not, she had a gun. Still can't imagine they had no choice but to take her life. Give me a break, man. Come on. 93? I've known some real young 93-year-olds, but, you know, come on. You talk about that. Whatever you want. That's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. We still got about a half an hour to kill until Dan McAdams and then Dar Jamail join us on the show to talk about Ukraine and then Iraq. But, of course, there's plenty of other stuff to talk about. Did you see this? There's so many things to talk about. I kind of don't want you to call because I want to talk about them. First of all, here's Hegel warns Americans of the risks of isolationism. If America does not maintain permanent global hegemony, then everything in the world will fall apart and it'll all catch on fire and go to war, and then we'll have to go to war and take care of it all anyway. So we might as well just keep taking care of it all along. Yeah? Well, who's going to pay for it all? Assuming that that's even true, even though, of course, I'm going to sit here chapter and verse off the top of my head how America makes everything worse for everybody. Let me count the ways. But even if that was true, how come somebody just happens to be from whatever county, Texas, owes the whole world their security when they're just trying to get by in their own lives and having a hard enough time? It's amazing that anyone thinks this is legitimate at all. Even if it were a fact, you know, his premise that American force is what keeps the peace, when, of course, the American military is the most violent force on the planet, bar none. And then get this. This, on one hand, it proves him right, but also how crazy and stupid these people are, too. Einhorn finds dinner chat with Ben Bernanke, quote, frightening. Oh, yeah. David Einhorn, manager of the $10 billion Green Light Capital Incorporated, said he found a recent dinner conversation with former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben S. Bernanke scary. Quote, I got to ask him all these questions that have been on my mind for a long time, Einhorn said in an interview with Eric Schatzker and Stephanie Ruhle on Bloomberg Television. It was sort of frightening because the answers were not better than I thought they would be. Einhorn, 45, has been critical of Bernanke's willingness to leave interest rates near zero for more than 5 years. The hedge fund manager has said the benefits of low stimulus has led to income inequality. Boy, there's a point you don't hear people making very often. But sounds right to me. Someone in the chat room asked, same guy that was going to buy the Mets? Probably. He's rich as hell. He thinks he's man enough to talk bad about the head of the central bank, so he better be really rich, right? Could buy a ball team. Like in the song. Oh, I guess that's supposed to be football. Never mind. The hedge fund manager has said that the benefits of low rates diminish over time and they're more harmful than helpful, and that the Fed's stimulus has led to income inequality. Bernanke, a former Princeton University economics professor, stepped down this year after 8 years at the central bank, since Greenspan. In describing the dinner conversation at New York, something or other, Einhorn criticized Bernanke for saying he was 100% certain there would be no hyperinflation and that it generally occurs after a war. Not that I think there will be hyperinflation, but how do you get to 100% certainty about anything, Einhorn said. Why can't you be 99% certain? And Bernanke responded, "You are wrong," to a question about the diminishing returns of having zero interest rates at zero, according to the hedge fund manager. The ex-Fed chief's explanation, Einhorn said, was that rising interest rates to benefit savers wouldn't be the right move for the economy because it would require borrowers to pay more for capital. Raising the price of money for loan would make it more expensive? That was his argument? That was what he said? I believe that. That's what he said. Not that he's right. That's absolutely incredible. But then I love this. We won't have hyperinflation because that usually happens, you know, if there's hyperinflation. That's after a war. Well, okay. What is it about a war? Oh, because government goes deep into debt and then they print huge amounts of currency to buy up that debt and debase the value of their currency and destroy the value of everyone's savings. And sometimes it gets so out of hand that it just completely breaks the economy apart. Hyperinflation, where the value of the money, the price of the money on any given day is changing so rapidly that all deals are broken. And the division of labor and trade and distribution of goods and services completely falls apart. And then people starve and riot and fight and embrace totalitarianism. But it's a good thing that America's not at war or anything. And I told you, they always inflate in order to pay for the wars. That's what it's all about. Some argue that's why they have so many wars. It's just because it creates so much debt and so much interest on bond sales and so much money out of nothing for so many people. For the government and the bankers both. I mean, you gotta figure just how much profit is made at JP Morgan Chase every time the government gives a contract to Lockheed. And Lockheed puts the money in the Chase. Cha-ching! I don't know what the percent is, but if it's really small, that's still a lot of money. Anyway. And so, yeah, now, as far as... this is just this guy's telling of an anecdote about Bernanke here, but... I mean, that sounds plausible to me, that when the guy says, like, hey, man, you know, maybe interest rates need to go higher, that Bernanke says, yeah, but then that'll make money cost more to borrow. Well, yeah, but maybe people who have money to loan out would like to charge more to loan it out. Maybe you're destroying even whatever pattern of or custom of saving we've had in this country at all now. To the degree it's already, you know, to the degree it still exists after decade upon decade of inflation. Anyway, I don't know. I just kind of like it because on the one hand, the way everyone can just kind of pretend that, no, there's no wars going on. No, they haven't borrowed trillions of dollars and printed at least hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars to buy up the bonds for all the debt that they created to kill all those Iraqis. You know, Stiglitz and Bilmes, they may be Keynesians or something, but seems like they can do accounting And their estimate is that just the Iraq War, never mind the whole terror war and the invasion of Africa and the and NATO expansion and the Asia pivot and all this crap, but just the Iraq War is going to be $5 trillion. They published a book called The $3 Trillion War, and then they wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post titled, "Sorry, we actually didn't take into account the long-term costs of all the wounded veterans' health care for the rest of their lives and for their families, too, and all that." And so, yeah, that go ahead and make that $5 trillion. And that's why they blew up the bubble of the last decade, was to make that war seem free. To make it seem like that stimulus check in your mailbox was your dividend for all that was being looted from the Iraqis. Although that wasn't true, they were just printing it out of nothing, debasing the currency and all that, borrowing it from China. But, you know, I don't know if there will be hyperinflation either, but I do know that they have increased the money supply by a lot, and that they have so far, they've come up with this scheme to pay the banks to just, not very much though, just a couple percent, to keep, to hang on to the money. To keep them from failing, but to encourage them to not just loan all the money out into circulation, and especially by way of the fractional reserve rate, because they're afraid of all that inflation. They're paying them not to loan it out. But assuming all the bad debts can clear somehow, and this economy can ever get back on the right foot again, the banks are going to want to start loaning out all that money. That's what they exist for. And that's where the real threat of hyperinflation exists. Not that any of these people need to worry about that. They know what they're doing.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
Hey, all, Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. All right, you guys. I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. We still got another segment. If anybody wants to call in the show, you can call in the show. It's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. You know the deal. Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Eastern Europe, NATO expansion, Ukraine, Guantanamo, police state, tech, militarization of the cops, NSA spying stuff, Rand Paul, whatever you want to talk about. There you go. It's 512-271-4836. Otherwise, I get a ton here, so leave me alone. First of all, I want to say, somebody in the chat room brought up Phil Hendry, the radio show host, Phil Hendry. Now, I haven't heard that guy in years. What was it, 2014? I probably hadn't heard him in 11 years, 12 years, something like that. But I used to hear him out of San Antonio, which I think was his flagship station out of there. And at least then, the way his show worked was he was the host of the show, and he was the guest, and he took calls. And the whole point of the show was he would interview himself as the guest, and he would really fool you. If you didn't know what you were listening to, he would switch mics, and he had the master board op. I mean, his board op must have been not a pot smoker. His board op was great, and he would switch mics all the time and switch voices and characters perfectly from himself, a pseudo himself character, to whoever his guest was. And he would start out pretty reasonable, and then he would end up, like, going some crazy thing. So, like, the one that's coming to mind is he would start out saying, well, you know, my grandson died over there in the Iraq War. Hey, my grandson died over there in the Iraq War. It's believable, though. It's not fake and cheesy and lame like me. And so I think everybody ought to, you know, salute his sacrifice and whatever. So all the callers are calling in going, yeah, man, that's right. Yeah. And then after a while, it kind of starts spinning out more and more. And eventually he's saying, yeah, so the government should have to pay my rent and everybody else's in my family's rent from now on. And he starts being a real, like, brat about it, right? This grandfather. And so the callers start, hey, what? And they start getting all angry and whatever. Meanwhile, it's just this guy. But he's so great of an actor. I mean, he was really great. And I would hear this day after day, stuck in traffic, driving a cab or whatever the hell I was doing, listen to this guy. And day after day, and he would get, and this is the joke of the show, right, is that the callers don't get it. And the callers are completely flipping out. Because by the end of whatever interview, he's got his quote-unquote guest is saying the most ridiculous stuff, like the most outrageous stuff, and just driving people up the wall. And so every show is just a contest to see just how mad he can drive the talk radio audience listener out there with his stuff. And it was just absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's about as brilliant as, you know, brain surgery or rocket science or whatever. It's mankind at its best. And I don't even know if the guy was pro-war, anti-war, or what, any of that kind of thing. It was more just an experiment with how much of an idiot you are, you know, how mad he can get you about some nonsense. And it was beautiful, man. It was just beautiful. And I don't know. I think I read somewhere that his show format has changed now. It's no longer exactly like that. But I just, since someone in the chat room was mentioning it, I just wanted to say that that, to me, is like the pinnacle of human achievement. Like, you know, the very best skateboarders, that kind of thing. That's as good as humanity gets right there. Awesome. All right, good. Okay, good. And let me see here. Boko Haram. I don't know who's a good expert about Boko Haram to interview, but I'll tell you that it occurs to me that the U.S. has been trying to find an excuse to invade Nigeria since 2007, and they hadn't needed our help. You might remember when anti-war radio really kind of first started there, I interviewed Sebastian Younger, who, he's the guy that made the movie Restrepo, by the way. But he had done this report out of the Niger Delta about these rebels who were fighting for their property rights, which Shell Oil had bribed the Nigerian central government into violating their property rights and handing over all their oil. And they said, hey, it's our property, and you're taking the oil right out from under our ancestral village that goes way the hell back. And not only that, but you're destroying all of our fishing grounds. And so you're destroying our livelihood by stealing our property. And so you better at least pay us. And remember, they would kidnap people, executives of Shell Oil. They'd kidnap them and then brainwash them into, hey, man, you guys ought to start doing the right thing. And then they would let them go without harming them. And then they would say, okay, now go back and tell your fellow executives that what's going on here isn't really right, man. And these people could have been paid off a pittance. And now I'm trying to remember, it was somebody that I interviewed about the Congo. Maybe it was the guy from The Nation that I interviewed about the Congo. Who was it? Does anybody in the chat room remember who it was that I interviewed who talked about how those guys don't exist anymore? The government of Nigeria went and wiped them out a long time ago. I don't know if that was with or without the American Special Forces or not. And I do not believe, at least, well, let me put it this way. I don't think I've ever come across even an accusation that what's really provoked Boko Haram into existence is American intervention there. Oh, good. Somebody's calling in the show. Hang on just one second, man. I'm going to wrap up this point real quick, caller, and I'll get right to you. But there's always going to be bark-eating religious reactionaries in the backwoods of things who don't like change and maybe fight back. But the worst thing that the U.S. could do was intervene. And I'll give you just one slight taste of that before I go to this caller, and that is that when Hillary Clinton about a year ago said, oh yeah, Boko Haram, that's Al-Qaeda in Nigeria, you know, it's all the global Islamo-fascist bin Ladenite caliphate, and we got to stop them because they're international terrorists, and we're putting them on the international terrorist list. The government of Nigeria said, no, please don't do that. These guys are, we got them marginalized, if not defeated, and we don't need you telling them how special and big they are and why they should never give up. So just butt out, please. But, of course, you know, the Americans, they just want a foothold in there anyway. And I don't know why. I think the Nigerian government is up to the challenge of this. You know, they've never had a problem getting the oil out of there. Not that I've ever heard of. But maybe it's just a fun place, like I was making fun yesterday. It's just a good place to go drive your little Swift boats, the new Swift boats with their newest machine guns, and find some new missions for some JSOC guys. You know, the latest inflated out of all proportion division of the Pentagon. I don't know. Invasion Africa. Whenever you hear anybody telling you a crocodile tears story about how much they love Africans and that's why they're intervening because they love them so much, you just Google Nick Terse first. And you see what Nick Terse has to say about America's invasion of Africa. And you tell me how much you think, hell, why don't you look at history and tell me how much you think the American state cares about the people of Africa and how much that motivates what it is that they do there. Hey, I'm Scott. You are on the air, whoever you are. And anybody else wants to get involved, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Go ahead.
Hey, Scott, great show. I did what every human on Earth should do. I went to antiwar.com and I read Justin Raimondo's article a couple of days ago about Ukraine, where, long story short, he said it's not stupidity, it is the plan. They are intentionally stirring things up, and he predicted that the Nazis in Ukraine would start to make a mischief in Russia proper inside of Mother Russia. Excellent hyperlinks, by the way. So my question is the one that whole article begs, which is, why the hell would they do that? Is the dollar about to break? Is the aliens about to land? Do you have any idea why the hell they would intentionally do that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how benevolent it is, but it's global hegemony. And Russia, even though it's no longer the Soviet Union, is still, in fact, independent from the United States. And they have major cards to play. And so we try to, up until now, under Putin, we've been, you know, and under the Bush years, we had our problems too. But there's sort of a frenemies kind of thing going on. And now they really are making it much worse and trying to escalate the entire situation. I think mostly that has to do with welfare for Lockheed. That's going to be part of our discussion with Daniel McAdams coming up here, is how they just can't keep it secret how delighted they are over at Lockheed headquarters about the escalation here. And I think that's going to be a big part of it. And just, you know, eventually, I don't know exactly what they think about China, but they've pretty much made it plain that the leaders of the nationalist right and the neoconservative war hawks that, you know, under the defense planning guidance and all of that, that they mean to dismember Russia eventually. They mean not just to get rid of the Soviet Union, but to at least have a regime change there if they can't have a Yeltsin, to figure out a way to tear the damn thing apart. You know, it's the same thing we do every day, try to take over the world. That's their game. And the Russians stand in their way, and the Russians are armed to the teeth with hydrogen bombs. So I guess, you know, the real top prize goes to whoever can figure out how to do it, in a color-coded, soft kind of way. But it sounds crazy to me. I'm sorry we're out of time, but you're right that it's stupid and wrong.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org, apsradionews.com, dailypulseradio.com, anomalyradio.com. I'm on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, and on and on like that. You got to Google, man. Look it up if you want. All right. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Daniel McAdams. For years and years, he was foreign policy advisor to Dr. Ron Paul in the House of Representatives, and now he is the head of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity at ronpaulinstitute.org. Welcome back to the show, Dan. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be with you again.
Good. It's very good to have you back on the show here. And, you know, in the midst of all this Ukraine crisis, I sure do like reading your stuff. You obviously already knew a lot about Ukraine going back. I don't know if you knew a lot before the last time America did a coup d'etat in Kiev, but you've certainly learned a lot. Maybe you can tell us about your background knowledge of this kind of thing, and then maybe steer us toward, well, I don't know. We don't want to do a whole summary here. I want to skip. Tell us any background, anything interesting about your background in this subject matter, and then we'll skip ahead to what's going on here with the attack on the building in Odessa the other day.
Sure. Well, actually, I spent most of the 90s living next door in Hungary. So I did a lot of traveling, a lot of election monitoring, didn't actually get into Ukraine, but quite familiar with the very complex historical and ethnic makeup of Ukraine. As you know, a tiny tip of Ukraine had been in historic Hungary, so you do have a Hungarian minority living there as well. So it's always been a very touchy situation. And also, you know, the whole sort of Soviet succession states has never really completely played itself out. So you did always have a tinderbox there. But, you know, as you mentioned, I was working for Dr. Paul back in 03 and 04 when the Orange Revolution 1.0 took place. And you remember, we even ran some on the site, some of Dr. Paul's statements at the time, mm-hmm. telling the U.S. to butt out, stop sending all these millions of dollars and doing all this training to people over there who are trying to overthrow their government. So, yeah, we've been watching this for a long time.
And then, so, I guess, you know, most listeners to this show, if not, they can go back, catch up. They can go to ronpaulinstitute.org, then go back to scotthorton.org, go through the archives and catch up a little bit. But we've basically got, I don't think it's really a right-left thing as much as a east-west thing. And there are clearly, you know, hardcore right-wing nationalists on the western side, which include these groups, Svoboda and Right Sector, who are pretty much outright neo-Nazis. I don't know what would distinguish them. The different kind of SS logo that they brandish compared to the lightning bolts or something. I don't know. And then I don't know if it's really kind of a left-wing led thing on the pro-Russian side at all, or whether they're, you know, pretty much conservatives too, but just with different loyalties, or how exactly that works out. Maybe you can fill us in. But we certainly had a building that was occupied by pro-Russian protesters in Odessa, which was attacked by, according to The Guardian and other sources, Right Sector. It was a pretty big crowd of people attacked and set the fire there. So I guess tell us everything you know about what actually happened there, and then how many people were killed and all of that. And then we can get into the media criticism here, which I think is, you know, really, it's exceptional what the degree of dishonesty and lie by omission here. It's really notable in its own right. Not quite as bad as the mass murder itself, but still pretty drastic. So tell us what you know about this protest and how it turned into this riot.
Yeah, I think Odessa is a really interesting situation. It's a terrible tragedy. I don't know that we will know everything that happened. I probably mistakenly I've watched so many minutes and hours of video taken from every angle of everything that happened. And from what I could see, and from what, you know, other people who shot the video could tell, there had long been an encampment in front of the trade union building. The anti-Kiev people, the people who are opposed to the U.S.-backed coup in Kiev in February, they sent up sort of a mini tent city there, as they had done on the Maidan, the other side, and had been camping there for a while. And apparently there was a soccer game, a football game that day, and the groups, from we could see in the video, came running down the street. They torched the tent city. The guys who are occupying it then went into the trade union building. The video looks pretty wild, like they were pretty, you know, intent on violence. I think there had been some violence at some point from the pro-East, you know, the anti-Kiev people. So it was sort of a give and take for a while. And then these groups went into the building. And you can, this is, you know, the media, which we'll talk about in a minute, you can clearly see the people outside, the pro-Kiev people, the, as you say, the right sector types, the extreme rightists. You can clearly see them throwing Molotov cocktails. Tragically, you can see some young gals, some young women filling up these Molotov cocktails with gasoline. So they happen, you know, they have to be considered accessories to murder, really. But you can see these guys throwing them in. And then we've seen some videos lately of the guys, the people who were trying to escape from the window as they were being burned. They stepped in front of the window and they were shot at by some of these right sector people. So this is clearly an act of mass murder against these anti-Kiev people. And as you point out, the way it's been covered in the West is very different from anyone. And these videos are available to anyone to see. You know, it's not like this is not some kind of secret. So,
yeah, I mean, in the footage from, I guess, the roof of a building across the street, something like that, you can see that as soon as they arrive, they just completely ransack all of the tents and all of that, and then blam goes the Molotov cocktail, was ready to go, goes soaring through the air, lands right on the front porch of the building there, right at the front door kind of area there.
But what I, you know, what I can, there are many things that I can't figure out, and a lot of people are speculating. There are things that, frankly, I just don't know. I don't understand why it seemed like there were pro-Kiev people in the building. I don't understand why so many of the victims had been shot in the face. And I don't understand why so many people were only burned from their neck up. You'll see pictures of them, and it's quite gruesome, but you'll see pictures of them where the, you know, from the neck down, they look completely normal, but from the neck up, they're completely burned. So there are so many strange things I don't understand. There are rumors that some sort of noxious gases were used to kill these people. Then they tried to burn them to cover the evidence. You saw one gruesome image of supposedly a woman who had been raped before she was burned alive. So it is very difficult to see the full picture, but clearly something very strange happened, and you have to wonder, who did the planning behind this? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it may not have been that well planned to be planned, but then again, you never really know.
Well, it's interesting.
Maybe you will, but not yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's troubling because you do, and I want to get into too much speculation here, but there were, I'm sure you saw the article in the German press over the weekend that the CIA and FBI had sent in dozens of people to advise the government in Kiev on how to put down these insurgencies,
right,
or these protests. You know, there's no evidence that they were directly involved in what happened in Odessa, but you do have to wonder. Some of these guys, I mean, the CIA operative guys are not schoolboys, you know. They're some pretty tough characters, so who knows?
Right. All right. Well, and so then the big question there is, before we get to the whole media thing, which is just a disaster, but it really, you know, more to the point, the more important question is, you know, what this symbolizes on the road to some kind of Ukrainian civil war. I mean, it had seemed to me that the new junta doesn't really have enough power to try to really take over the East. They've made somewhat half-hearted attempts and have been, you know, mostly foiled. And so it seemed like, well, you know, maybe there's not enough for those who would reject their rule to push back against. And maybe the, you know, the bad spirits here can sort of, you know, wind their way down and cooler heads can prevail rather than the thing escalating. But it seems like, you know, the government in Kiev keeps trying to push it. And things like this, where it's, you know, dead civilian activists, not battles among even quote unquote militants, but basically dead activists at the hands of brown shirts, this is the kind of thing that makes it much harder for cooler heads to prevail. But, you know, I don't know. I don't want to be too bad of a doomsayer. You think that maybe it could be negotiated? What if the Americans and the Russians really tried, you know, really wanted to and really tried to hammer this thing out and come to a peaceful agreement? You think they could?
Well, I think one of the big problems is that the U.S. side has been so disingenuous from the beginning. You know, they've insisted that we know for a fact that the Russians are involved in these protests. They've been infiltrating them. They've given them weapons, and they know it for a fact. Yet every single time they've come forth with a piece of evidence, it's been refuted. if you remember, General Breedlove a while ago came forth and said, oh, we have this satellite image of all these tanks and this buildup. It turns out it was a couple of years old. Then they came again and said, oh, we've got these pictures of these guys, you know, these same guys who were in Georgia and Russia and Ukraine. Well, the guy who took the picture said, that's bogus. That's not true.
Right.
And on and on, several times.
Yeah, in fact, the New York Times had a thing where they really investigated and said, no, these are really all Ukrainians. They may be pro-Russian, but they're to a man. They're Ukrainians.
To their credit, they actually sent someone in there, and the New York Times is... It's definitely not a pro-Russia paper.
Robert Perry called it a sort of retraction because they didn't really say, we were wrong the other day, but they were definitely contradicting themselves, as you put it, admitting it that, like, yeah, we're, you know, sort of.
Sure, and the.
Not quite fast enough. I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We got to take this big break, but then we'll be right back with Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dan McAdams. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity at ronpaulinstitute.org. This piece is called U.S. Media Covers Up Mass Murder in Odessa, Ukraine. And again, it's a murder at the hands of the right sector, brown shirt, Banderas types. And I'm sorry, because I forget where I interrupted you when we had to go out to that break. Dan, you remember the thought you were going to try to finish there?
Oh, no, we were just talking about the disingenuousness of the U.S. administration. You were wondering if these two governments could get together somehow, U.S. and Russia, and talk this thing back. You know, I think there's some potential for that. I think there are other stakeholders that should be involved. You know, obviously the people in Kiev, because of facts on the ground, do have control. They should be part of it. But also the people in the East who are unhappy with the Kiev government should be stakeholders.
The Americans, or the Western side, if they've thrown in their lot with the West, I mean, they've got to know how unreliable we are, or our governments are, of course. It seems like if they can make matters worse, so much the better for them, to a point. I mean, if the assumption is that the worst that they could do would be to lose the East to Russia, at least, you know, they would hope that that would solidify their support from the Western side, something. I mean, I don't know, when that leak of the gas princess, Yulia Tymoshenko, was released, and she was saying, yeah, you know, nuke East Ukraine and all of those pro-Russian bastards, whatever. She didn't really mean kill them all, but what she meant was she hated them all, and she was basically, I don't know if it was a provocation by her, basically an escalation. It was a renunciation of any pretended legitimacy that she might have or her party might have to rule them by declaring them basically all outlaws and enemies of the state who, you know, might as well be Russians or whatever. And so
she repeated that yesterday, where she said that, you know, we need to get a militia together. We need to get volunteers together to come out and go out to the East, you know, and basically take care of these people, you know.
So the government in Kiev, they're not trying to work this out. They're trying to, you know, prove that they're the state, that they have a monopoly here, and they're going to go and do an anti-terrorist operation. I guess the Americans could make them cool their jets, but the Americans are encouraging them to go ahead and follow through like this.
But yet, at the same time, they claim that the Russians need to de-escalate. Well, as, you know, as a New York Times story, the lack of evidence, everything else demonstrates there's really nothing to de-escalate, because, believe it or not, the Russians aren't in there, you know? I mean, I can imagine Putin pulling his hair out, saying, how many times do we have to tell you?
Right.
You know, and it comes to the point where the U.S. is irritated with Russia for having troops on its own soil. You know, this from a country with troops in, what, how many, 120 countries across the world? You know, but what I think is
interesting, in fact, the AP is reporting right now that Putin is claiming, at least, which this is pretty verifiable, that his troops, he has called his troops to back off from the Ukraine border. He's trying to de-escalate for his part, at least that much.
Exactly. Well, there was a meeting between Putin and the current head of the OSCE, who happens to be the president of Switzerland, and basically three huge steps back on the part of Putin, which I think are going to irritate people who on both sides, because some people think that Putin is going to rush in and save the day, and anyone who studies his behavior in the past knows that that is not how he operates. You know, they're the Putinistas or whatever you want to call them who think he's going to do the smackdown. That's not going to happen. But anyway, what happened today is Putin said the referendum in Donetsk should be postponed and to allow negotiations to take place. The presidential election scheduled for later this month might be a good step in the right direction in Ukraine. And as you pointed out, he said, we'll pull back our troops even further. These are three pretty significant climb downs on his part. And what does the State Department spokesman Jen Psaki say? Oh, he's not doing enough to de-escalate. Is this clearly not satisfactory enough? They're not pulling the troops back enough. He hasn't gone far enough. So it's just, you know, they're not allowing diplomacy to take place whatsoever. They're too busy doing selfies and putting up hashtags on Twitter to actually sit down like adults and try to talk this out.
Right. Well, and, you know, of course, the other headline is that how many? 30, more than 30 terrorists killed in fighting yesterday, and four Ukrainian soldiers. And so, I mean, they really keep escalating this from the American side. Before, you know, just the other day, it was five killed at a checkpoint somewhere by some right sector guys. But in most of the places where the military had attempted to intervene, they'd been turned back and even disarmed by the civilian protesters who just said, absolutely not. You will not pass, kind of thing. And they kind of said, all right.
Yeah,
that happened a few times, but it looks like they said, Kiev ain't backing down here at all. Putin is, as you're saying.
Yeah, well, a lot of these poor guys said, all right, by the way, do you have any bread? Because we haven't been fed in a while. You know, so I think where you did have regular military go in, that's when you did see a lot of them turn, a lot of them back down. But what I think the danger, and I think you alluded to it, they're not able to count on their military, so they're having to recruit some of these right sector types. They have been training, from what I understand, in military and paramilitary techniques for quite some time. So these guys are quite dangerous. They're quite violent. And these are the kinds of people that they're able to recruit to send to the East. And it's just a recipe for disaster because the people in the East feel like they're fighting for their homeland and their way of life. You know, they feel that the government that went into power in Kiev is not legitimate. It was put together by a coup supported by the West. And so therefore, if that's accepted, then they have the same right to dissent as the original guys did in Kiev. And the U.S., who supported the guys in Kiev, all of a sudden are talking about how you have to crack down and let them know the law. I mean, this is a government that is using its own military against its own people. They're using helicopter gunships to shoot at some of these checkpoints. They're killing people with helicopter ships, with RPGs. This is the kind of thing that the U.S., when it's a government it doesn't like, uses as a pretext for an invasion. You know, you remember Gaddafi is killing his own people. But somehow it's okay when the people that the U.S. wants killed are getting killed. That sounds a bit extreme, but...
Hey, we saw it in Egypt last summer where, you know, Morsi, nobody better get hurt under Morsi, but al-Sisi, Field Marshal Sisi, can kill whoever he wants.
Yeah, well, there was well over 1,000, wasn't it? Now there's another 1,000 sentenced to death.
Yeah, I mean, that's not controversial, honestly. As horrible as it sounds, the facts of the matter are pretty clear there. You know, as far as, you know, what human rights means, doing what you're told by the USA. But now, so two things in very, very short order to discuss left here, which is, do you think that the Americans and their buddies in Kiev can make this bad enough that they really do provoke a Russian invasion? Or how likely do you think that is, that Putin ever would actually go ahead and invade eastern Ukraine? You got to admit, it'd be nice to control Odessa, whatever empire you're the head of, right? And so there's that. And then the other thing is about just the larger context of creating a new Cold War at all costs, almost, it seems like, is the real agenda. And you have virtually no time to answer both of those. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I saw an article the other day that Lockheed Martin is thrilled by what's happening in the region, and they're rolling out a bunch of new products to sell to these countries. So that tells you a lot. Can they provoke a Russian reaction? I think it's possible, but I don't think Russia wants East Ukraine. They want them as a trading partner, but they don't want to own it. The place is a mess. Who would want it? It's broken. And right. I think Putin understands that. The third thing, Odessa, if you know, is the home to one of the largest, if not the largest, Jewish community in Russia. And I think they've got to be scared crapless over what's happening with these right sector thugs coming in. So I think if you see these guys doing something in that respect, I think you might see Russia getting a little bit more upset.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know who's supposed to come down and make the most powerful people in the world cool it. They're the highest ranking leaders Earth has, the American and the Russian presidents. So let's hope they can figure this out. Thank you so much for your time and your information, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
That's Dan McAdams, everybody. RonPaulInstitute.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quotes, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest on the show today is the great Dar Jamail, the brave Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter from the Iraq War. He's got this piece in truthout.org on bringing war criminals to justice. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the current state of Iraq as well. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Dar?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Good. Very happy to have you here. So let's start with this article here on bringing war criminals to justice. You went to to London, and you participated in this thing. I'm trying to find the name of it. I thought I had it in front of me, but now it's gone. The Iraq Commission Conference, I guess, is just the title of it, right? Oh, in Brussels. Pardon me. I thought it was in London. And so what was the Iraq Commission Conference? Tell us all about it.
Yeah, this was a group of activists and international lawyers that met a few weeks ago in the middle of April in Belgium. And the goal was to provide, listen to testimony from folks from Iraq, both Iraqis themselves, as well as journalists like me, as well as Ross Caputi, a soldier who served during the second siege of Fallujah. And all of us provided testimony to a group of international lawyers that was there already, because it was the Iraq Commission coincided with the 18th annual conference of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, the IADL. And so there were about 70 international lawyers there from 50 different countries. And the idea of the Iraq Commission part of this was to bring in all of this testimony and to start crafting a international coalition of lawyers to start working towards, okay, what can be done since the U.S. is not a member of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, what can be done nevertheless to try to sort of fence them in. So for example, like Rumsfeld cannot go to Germany, because if he does, there's enough legal organization there and citizen resistance that he could legitimately be arrested. So things like that, things tied in with what happened recently in the U.S. where college students got together and basically thwarted Condoleezza Rice from giving a commencement address because they didn't want a war criminal speaking at their school. So things like that, so that activists are taking part in doing that, along with international lawyers, literally trying to set up hard and fast machinations that can be used in the future to hopefully bring justice in the court of law, whether it's in the ICC or otherwise, further down the road towards people like Rumsfeld, Bush, Wolfowitz, Powell, etc., who are responsible for the disaster in Iraq.
Right. Well, you know, it's too bad because I sure would like to see the American people insist on the prosecution of these people under American law for what they've done. But you know what? If somebody else wants to convict them, that's fine. Because you're not allowed to, you know, start wars and murder people like that. Somebody's got to enforce it. And anyway, to hell with all of them. I'm for sure now. I think, well, I don't know. So tell me, do you think it's actually possible to really, you know, use the system of so-called international law here? Because after all, it's all political how it's applied and always will be. But that they're really, you think it's possible, or what, could you give it a percentage chance of success or something, that somehow these different institutions could basically be trapped into following through and really putting Donald Rumsfeld in prison for the rest of his miserable life? Or, I mean, I appreciate the stunt anyway. If nothing else, it shows what complete and ridiculous hypocrites they are when they claim to be the leaders of the oldest constitutional republic on earth and all of that, when they have nothing but the greatest of contempt for even the theory of the rule of law.
Well, that really is the bottom line question, Scott, is this really feasible? Is something really legitimately going to come out of this? And certainly the odds are long against it. But, you know, that's why I mentioned the U.S. not into, you know, this is, of course, as you said, politically and by very clear design, the U.S. will not join the International Criminal Court, because if they did, just about every U.S. president in the last at least 80 years, possibly longer than that, could theoretically be tried there for one reason or another. But there is one interesting case that I'll point out that is actually happening as we speak. There is a lawyer from San Francisco named Inder Kumar. He runs his own successful law firm there, and he is representing an Iraqi single mother who is now in Jordan, who has suffered damages from the invasion and occupation. And she has filed a class action lawsuit against Bush, Cheney, Powell, Rice, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz in a federal court in California. And she's alleging that all of those people who planned and waged the Iraq war violated international law, going by the Nuremberg principles. And I spoke with Kumar at the conference, and he said, me as a lawyer, I was really inspired by the Nuremberg trials and the principles that came from them. And he said, look, an international war of aggression is the mother of all war crimes, as outlined during Nuremberg.
Right.
And so he's trying to use the Nuremberg principles to take up a federal court case in U.S. court. And that case is happening. He's waiting to get word from the court now on if the case is going to be accepted. And if it does, it would literally be the first time that a case has been accepted by a U.S. federal court, and would obviously set precedent. Now, it is a long shot. Is it going to happen? Probably not, but we don't know yet. It is still a possibility.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting about this to me, and what was fleshed out after his testimony at the Iraq Commission, and then what was discussed later by other international lawyers, is that if his case goes forward, then it has set the stage for a template that could be used in every other U.S. state, as well as other countries around the world, to start using this as a way to start filing charges in various courts against these war criminals.
Right. Well, you know, obviously the system is rigged in the first place by the Security Council powers to use these laws against their enemies. So, you know, conviction of a Charles Taylor or something like that, which I think they convicted him, right?
They did.
It's, you know, it's great to see something like that. It doesn't mean necessarily that it could apply to the politicians of the nations who really do the enforcing necessarily. But then, you know, the other Scott Horton has pointed out on the show, the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, that sometimes dictators have gone decades free, sometimes one decade, sometimes two or three, and then the law catches up with their sorry asses and they end up going to prison. Now, Rumsfeld ain't got 3 decades left, and I don't know whether, you know, real cabinet level or presidential level
American officials could ever be really held accountable for any crimes. I think the boat sailed there with Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon and the pardon, but the point sure is important, and they sure do deserve to be convicted. You know, the guy, Vincent Bugliosi, is that it? Am I saying his name right? The guy that convicted Charles Manson said that, you know, under American law, George Bush is guilty of murder. Simple as that. That any prosecutor in America could prosecute him for killing American soldiers, for getting them killed when he knew he was lying. When the official NIE said that, yeah, we think that he's got some chemical weapons, but we judge with high confidence, the official position of the U.S. intelligence community in 2002 was that Saddam Hussein would never use chemical weapons against the United States. The only instance he might ever use them would be if we invaded. He might use them to defend Baghdad from our invasion. That was in the NIE of 02. So he said either Condoleezza Rice is guilty of murder because she lied to the president about what the NIE said, or he's guilty of murder. They both are, for pretending it said something it didn't, or what have you. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of different sets of laws. The ones that you talk about on the international level about the war crime of aggression as the supreme war crime, and all of that. But on the local level too, for getting Johnny killed by pretending this had anything to do with protecting us from terrorism and weapons of mass destruction when they knew it wasn't right. And when, in fact, they admitted it when Wolfowitz said, well, you know, it was the one thing that we could agree on for bureaucratic reasons to use as the casus belli, not that we really thought it was a problem. So, anyway, point is, they're guilty as hell, and I think this kind of thing, no matter what, is really important that people really see that and see the hypocrisy that you kind of have to have an unofficial kind of commission just to even really make the point. But anyway, somewhere between 500,000 and a million people were killed in that aggressive war, which, again, they knew better than, and all the information is out now, even about the sources they had at the highest levels of Saddam Hussein's government verifying he had no weapons of mass destruction on the eve of war. All that stuff's come out by now. So it really, all it would take would be for the rule of law to be a real thing, and these guys would be in the pen right now. That's the real point.
Well, that's exactly right. And, another thing that came up at the conference was that it's very important that people keep doing like what you're doing right now, of just keeping all these facts in public consciousness, keep the discussion going. Don't let this just slide by and let people forget about it. Keep reminding people that precedent was set by American prosecutors during the Nuremberg trials in Germany post-World War II, where they convicted Nazi leaders. And those same precedents apply today to the Iraq War and the Bush administration officials responsible.
Absolutely. All right, now hold it right there. I'm sorry we got to take this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Dar Jamail from darjamail.net right after this. Oh, and truthout.org, too. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is where I keep all my archives. You can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dar Jamail. He's got this great piece at truthout.org. It's actually a two-parter on bringing war criminals to justice. It's the Bush administration and their aggressive war against Iraq. And, well, in this case, I mean, we could be talking about Obama and Libya, right? But that's a different interview. So, let's talk about what's going on in Iraq right now. Wonderful, perhaps glorious, purple-fingered democracy, right, Dar? So what you complaining about? Ends, means, omelets, paradise. Now, they're way better off.
That's right. They're reveling in their fledgling democracy, happily voting while scores of bodies piling up at morgues across the country on a daily basis. Well, we had yet another so-called election again, fraught with controversy, all kinds of evidence and allegations of corruption, which most certainly has been the case in every election that's happened there so far. You know, for starters, we still have vast swaths of the country not even able to participate in the election, i.e. Al-Anbar province, or at least many parts of it, because violence is so intense. But nevertheless, the election took place about 8 days ago on at the end of last month. And once again, no big surprise, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who continues to maintain very strong links to the government in the U.S., who have sold him over $20 billion of weapons and training to date, and that is an ongoing, a dynamic figure, let's put it that way. But once again, his State of Law party has won the largest number of votes. Looks like he will remain in power. He is certainly fulfilling the moniker that he's got across much of Baghdad, where he's now known as the Shia Saddam, because he is ruling like a dictator. But the vote hasn't yet been totally confirmed. That's supposed to happen on 25 May. But the unofficial results show that his State of Law party has received, again, the majority of votes. So it looks like he will stay in power while violence and chaos continues across the failed state that is Iraq today, excepting the Kurdish-controlled north. Mm-hmm.
Does his old party, the United Iraqi Alliance, still exist on the Shiite side?
It does not. It dissolved into other various parties. You know, it's a dynamic situation. All the political horse trading that's going on behind closed doors continues within the Shia, within the Sunni, within the Kurds. And so every election, it's a little bit different landscape. So no, that party is dissolved, and it's basically been absorbed into the State of Law.
And so now, is the State of Law, is that basically just the Dawa party?
It really is, by and large. Yeah, it's everyone who's maintained allegiances to Maliki, which at this point, you know, we know it's not the Sadrists, we know it's not Fadila, it's not any of the other parties, it's certainly not the Shia, the Sunni parties, or the Kurds, who are very much at odds with the State of Law party and Maliki's policies for reasons you and I have talked about in other interviews. But it's very, very fragmented, and it's another reason why, for the most part, gridlock in the parliament there has become chronic, much like it is in Lebanon or D.C. for that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now, so if I'm remembering right, the election in January 05, part of what was such a disaster there was because the Sunnis boycotted it. They knew they were going to lose big time. And so they stayed out. Maybe they didn't have much opportunity to vote in the first place. And then that's what really precipitated the civil war more than anything else, was because the United Iraqi Alliance, for that one, was made up of the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and their Bada Brigades, who set about kicking all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad, which, you know, it took killing a few hundred thousand of them to get the job done there. And then so in the election of 2009, I guess the Sunnis really did try to vote in that one, and they actually beat Maliki, but then he still won anyway with American help. But now this time around, it sounds like they've boycotted and or didn't even have an opportunity to participate in all in this election. Did I summarize that even right, going back over the last few, or not?
No, that is right. You know, the only thing you were just barely off on was the 2010 election, which was
I'm sorry. I was thinking it was right after Obama took office for some reason. Or it was a year off.
No, aside from that, you really just lined it out a perfect summation. And, you know, and I think it is important to point out what you mentioned, too, that during the last election, Maliki actually did lose the election. He lost out. It was a very close vote, but Ayed Alawi actually won. But because the U.S. wanted to keep Maliki in power, he stayed in power. So much for democracy and legitimate votes. But yeah, what's the problem is, and you know, you gave the perfect intro to the statement, is that because of the ongoing marginalization of the Sunni, because once again, you know, Iraqi forces have continued to surround Fallujah, and as we speak, it looks like they're about to begin any time now, from now on the next couple of days, a full-scale offensive to try to retake the city. That, you know, these chronic problems, you know, sectarian-based, because Maliki, he's been accused of and very much has continued to play the sectarian card, continues to keep the political instability in the country, and that really is the root of the problem.
Yeah, well, and then you have Ayman al-Zawahiri. I think, actually, this is kind of a parenthesis, some good news. It seems like Zawahiri from Pakistan is again insisting that ISIS go home to Iraq, and it seems like some politician might advise him that since he has no means of enforcing that, he should kind of shut up, because he already said that once, and they told him to get lost, old man, or something, and they're still over there fighting, and I guess they're fighting in Iraq, too, but they certainly have not called off their Syria operations. But this is a big part of what's going on again, right, is that right as the tribes in the Sunni tribal leaders in Anbar have absolutely had it up to here with Maliki and his refusal to provide any government service or really to treat them as anything but outlaws in the first place, you have this massive foreign-backed war going on in Syria across the border, which is completely re-energizing the entire Iraqi jihadist movement. And so then the Sunni tribes, I guess, are happy to use them against Maliki for, I don't know what gain they think they're getting out of it, but it seems like that, or I don't know, is it the case, do you think, that the tribal leaders have unleashed the jihadist types, or it's sort of outside their control? Because I know Maliki's been, you know, like you said, the siege of Fallujah, he's just been shelling the town like he's the U.S. Marine Corps.
That's right. Well, it's really the jihadist forces, the extremist groups have been largely operating on their own. I think there's probably been a little bit of collaboration with the tribes, but for the most part, that has not been the case. And the thing is, Iraq is such a fragmented, lawless, chaotic, failed state at this point, though, that I think what collaboration has happened within some of the organized tribal resistance in Iraq and the extremist groups has been, hey, look, you guys are here, you're well armed, you have your own funding, and if you're, you know, kind of going back to the Arab proverb of, you know, the enemy of my friend is my enemy, and not that they're friends, but that they're basically fighting together. These are more warm bodies to the fight to go up against a very well-armed, not necessarily well-trained, but a very well-armed and U.S.-supported, by default through Maliki, Iraqi army.
Yeah. And as it was 9 and 10 years ago.
Right, as it's been the entire time Maliki's been in power. And that's why we have these same chronic problems if with no political representation and legitimacy in the government for the minority groups, i.e. the Sunni, we're going to have this kind of ongoing chronic violence. And again, now with Maliki once again about to solidify power after another rubber stamp, corrupted so-called election, again, where is the end? How long is this going to continue? Certainly it's not going to end anytime soon.
Yeah, well, and it's too bad that I don't know if you saw the thing by, we're almost out of time. I'm sorry, Dar. If you saw the thing in the New Yorker, kind of says, oh, if only America was still there, things would be better. But other than that, I mean, they really talk about just what a poor job Maliki has done of working with others in ways that he could, and still they wouldn't be a threat to him, but he treats everybody like an enemy. It really is making a Saddam out of himself where he doesn't have to, and at the expense of his own power, really. But anyway.
That's correct. I mean, he's really put himself in this situation by trying to play this strong-arm president, which is exactly how he ran again in this election. And he keeps rigging the elections to his favor. And Iraq is such a lawless state that he's really embedded himself into a place of power now. And I don't really see that changing. You know, for
yeah,
even
I wonder if there'll ever be an election there again. Really. All right. Well, I'm sorry we're all out of time. Thanks so much for your time, Dar Jamil. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Scott.
That's Dar Jamil, everybody. DarJamil.net. Check him out, truthout.org. See you tomorrow.